Greetings to each one of you once more in Jesus' name. Like I said the first night, that is both comforting and reassuring to be able to stand up and give that salutation, to stand under His shadow, under His blood, and under His grace. We've been asking questions to the children, and I'm pretty sure the questions are going to the parents too. Little Bible quiz questions for you to dig out, and I tried to make one really, really hard for the last night, and some of you got it before they left for church last evening. But I mean, somebody else is still waiting, trying to figure out what is the name of the man who looked into heaven and saw his name there? How many of you got it? Put your hands up. Yeah, well, this congregation needs somebody to make harder questions than I can. All right. Who didn't answer a question yet? Put your hand up if you didn't. Well, okay, young lady back here in the middle. Who looked into heaven and saw his name written there?
John.
John. Are you sure? The Bible doesn't say that. Well, it does and it doesn't. Turn to Revelation 21. I have a text from here anyway, so we'll just turn there. And this occurred to me at our home congregation. We used the Rod and Staff Sunday School material, and they just went through a study on the book of Revelation. And we came through this, we were just reading it in class, and I heard this, and I said, wow, what would that be like? It says in verse 14. Okay, it's talking about this wall, great and high, and had their 12 gates and their 12 angels, and names were written on, which were the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. And then there's gates, 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 and gates. And then it's a wall that has 12 foundations, and in them, the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And he talked with me. John was standing there looking at the wall, and he saw the names of him and his equals. And the other thing I thought about that is I have already heard people sort of poo-poo Acts chapter 1, that thing of ordaining by casting of the lot was done before the coming of the Spirit. And I even heard one man say, and he never heard of Matthias again. The Bible doesn't talk about Matthias again. And I would like to go back now and find that man and ask him who the 12th name is. If he thinks it's Judas or if it's Matthias. It's got to be one or the other. Because that was how they came up with 12. Unless it's Paul. But now we're just guessing. But it still was fascinating. What would that be like to be shown a vision into heaven and see your name written on the wall, on the foundation? It probably was one of the secrets that John had that carried him to faithfulness. I don't know. It just was fascinating. Well, thank you for all your hard work. I'm sorry I couldn't come up with one that you just couldn't get. I kind of had that goal, but I guess you're smarter than I thought you were. Or smarter than I am, maybe is what it is. For a message this evening, I would like to pull some thoughts out of Revelation 21 and 22. I want to talk about heaven for our inspiration, for our encouragement, for our teaching. I want to read most of all of 21 and a little bit into 22. This is the back end of the Bible. It's the tail end of the Bible. It's the end of the Bible trail. And it sort of ends up where I expect my journey, if I am faithful, to end up. And that's why 21 and 22 mean a lot to me. Verse 1, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, 'Behold,'" there's that word again, "'behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away.' And he that sat upon the throne said, 'Behold, I make all things new.' And he said unto me, write, for these words are true and faithful. And he said unto me, it is done. I am Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give unto him that is athirst of the fountain of water of life freely. He that overcometh shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the fearful and the unbelieving and the abominable and the murderers and the whoremongers and the sorcerers and the idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burneth with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. And there came unto me one of the seven angels which had the seven vials full of the seven last plagues and talked with me, saying, come hither, and I will show thee the bride, the Lamb's wife. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me that great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. And her light was like unto a stone most precious, even like a jasper stone, clear as crystal. And at a wall, great and high, and 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and the names written thereon, which were the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. On the east 3 gates, and on the north 3 gates, and on the south 3 gates, and on the west 3 gates. And the wall of the city had the 12 foundations, and in them the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And he that talked with me had a golden reed to measure the city, and the gates thereof, and the wall thereof, and the city lieth foursquare, and the length is as large as the breadth. And he measured the city with the reed 12,000 furlongs. The length and the breadth and the height of it are equal. And he measured the wall thereof 144 cubits, according to the measure of a man, that is, of the angel. And of the building of the wall, it was of jasper. The city was pure gold, like unto clear glass. And the foundations of the wall of the city were garnished with all manner of precious stones. And many of them we don't even really know. Jasper, sapphire, chalcedony, emerald, sardonyx, sardis. The seventh is chrysolite. The eighth is beryl. The ninth is topaz. The tenth is chrysoprasus. The 11th adjacent, the 12th an amethyst, and the 12 gates were 12 pearls, and every gate was of one pearl, and the street of the city was pure gold, as it were transparent glass. And I saw no temple therein, and the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it. And the city had no need of the sun, neither of the moon to shine in it, for the glory of God did lighten it, and the Lamb is the light thereof. And the nations of them which are saved shall walk in the light of it, and the kings of the earth do bring their glory and honor into it. And the gates of it shall not be shut at all by day, for there is no night there. And they shall bring the glory and honor of the nations into it, and there shall be in no wise enter into it anything that defileth, neither whatsoever worketh abomination, nor maketh a lie, but they which are written in the Lamb's book of life. And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of God and of the Lamb, and in the midst of the street of it, and was there the tree of life, which bare 12 manner of fruits, and yielded her fruit every month, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. And there shall be no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him, and they shall see his face, and his name shall be in their foreheads, and there shall be no night there, and they need no candle, neither the light of the sun, for the Lord God giveth them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. And he said unto me, these sayings are faithful and true. And the Lord God of the holy prophets send his angels to show unto his servants the things which must be shortly, be done. Behold, I come quickly. Blessed is he that keepeth the sayings of the prophecy of this book. I could read on, but I'll just stop there. You recognize this. It's one of the more familiar passages. We tend to turn there from time to time because we need to have the vision of this place to recur in our consciousness. It ought to want to go there, to have hope to go there. Ever since Jesus does his work, if you believe in your heart and confess that he is the Christ, we move into a place of acceptance. And the promise of John 14 stands on its own merit. Let not your heart be troubled. Ye believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you, behold, I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again and will receive you unto myself, that where I am, there you may be also. I think I made a few mistakes, but that's the best I can do with John 14. But I think about it, and when life is good, I almost forget. And when it is bad, I desperately want it to happen now. that promise that where I am, there you may be also. I will come and get you. And then he took this beloved apostle, the best friend of Jesus, and he said, I want to show you. I'd send his angel to show it to him what it looked like. And I know that we can dig down into this and go into the descriptions and try to figure out what glass that is transparent or gold that's pure, so pure that it's transparent. And you can start to contend about these things. Please don't waste your time. It's not worth contending about things we don't have quite figured out. And people will assert this, but there is material here that our simple minds can latch a hold of and receive, and it becomes anchor, an anchor of the soul. We're not home yet. We're not home yet. But when we get there, it will be worth it. You look at some of the measurements and things, and I'm reminded of one of our of an old preacher that we used to listen to when I was a boy. He would come, I mean, he was in our church groups, and he loved to preach about heaven. And one of his lines was that heaven is a place of stupendous magnitude. Stupendous magnitude. And that doesn't mean it's stupid. It means that it's dumbfounding. When you start letting your mind wander of what's presented here, it just stretches our imagination and our fascination to the point where we start losing our equilibrium. And it's magnificent, too. But as I look at this passage tonight, what I want to look at is one particular set of characteristics that are taught here that I believe are something we ought to be aware of. And when we are aware of it, it'll move us. It'll carry us. It will be a comfort to us. I'm talking in particular about the state of heaven. Now, the word state, as I used it here for a title, the state of heaven, is the condition of a person or thing with respects to its circumstances or attributes. Okay. We are mortals that are constantly being influenced by the state of affairs in our world. You just take something like the weather, and we are rather soft in our experience of authorizing ourselves to be grumpy in February because it's grumpy outside. The weather is grumpy. It's gray and it kind of short days, and we don't get as much sunlight as we ought to be having, things like that. And the state of our weather affects our moods, and we give it labels, and then we think we have it explained. But our financial status affects our home. People, there are marriages that fight about money because there's not enough, and the state of their finances is troubling and agitating. All of us, most of us anyway, have dreams, and we know what it's like to have our bubbles burst, and it affects us. The state of, or the mood is affected. But when we talk about the state of heaven, we're talking about the conditions that affect our mood or affect a person or thing with respect to its attitudes. About 20 years ago, my grandfather, who was a minister in the Eastern Church for all my life and way back beyond that, came to a place where he was no longer able to physically. He was bumping upper 80s, and he was no longer preaching anymore. And he told his sons and son-in-laws and his grandchildren that they can come in and go through his library and just help themselves to whatever we would like to have. And the sons and son-in-laws got to go first, and then the wee cousins got. And I picked up a little booklet that was on his shelf called Heaven, a Place, a City, and a Home. And it was written by a man in the early 1900s. And all he wanted to do was, they said he was known to be always talking about heaven, but it was not so much, he was not the kind of man that he wanted to talk about heaven so he could wow people with what he had figured out. He would talk about it, they said, this is what the introduction said, that Mr. Bounds, Edward Bounds, would talk about heaven in sort of a wistful way that left you understanding that he'd sort of like to go there today. And I've always remembered it. And he says in his first chapter that heaven is a state. It's a state of enthronement, elevation, and emancipation. And that caught my eye, and I went back and I went through this passage, and I actually found a couple more E's that describe the state of heaven. Not so much gold and pearls and jacinths and amethysts, but what it's like to be there and what it's like when we get there, the state of things. And that's what we're going to just do now. We're just going to go back through what I read, and we're going to talk about these E words. I'll try and put them up here without breaking more chalk. Number one, heaven is a state of elation. Now, the word elation means marked by high spirits. Heaven is heaven. Why? And as I pondered this point, but why is the mood high when people get to heaven? Why is the mood high with the Lord when people get to heaven? One of the things that we take a little time to read it all out in your scriptures. But you have a book on your lap that starts out, "In the beginning, God." And on the sixth day, God, being three persons, we know now, it doesn't say it that way in that first passage, but God said, "Let us make man in our own image." And what happened there is that Jehovah, with all of his might and with all of his sovereignty and with all of his capacity, made a crowning glory in this creation, and there was a purpose for this crowning glory. And the purpose was that it would be creation that relates back to him. Now, all of creation glorifies him. The stars twinkle in their courses. The seasons come and the seasons go. But then he made this crowning glory, and he did something dramatically different that he didn't do with anything else. And in that place, what he did is he went down and went to it. He gave it a breath. And when he gave that creation a breath, he made it a being that was alive with his life, and therefore it was ready to be his associate. Maybe that's not the right word. But from then on, the purpose of man was to take care of the garden, but also to meet with him in the cool of the day and talk. And sin really butchered that plan. Now, this was not a surprise, because before they ever made the world and laid its foundations, there was a divine discussion about what we were going to do when this happens. And the Bible brings that out, a number of the New Testament scriptures. But all through time, God, in his mercy, grace, and justice, and holiness, and love, was working together to rebuild, to reconnect that which was lost. He didn't can the race. He redeemed it through his Son, Jesus Christ. And it's to bring back a people. In the Old Testament, you have the Old Covenant with the children of Israel, the seed of Abraham, and he had this people. And it would do us good to just go back and watch God working with those obstinate Israelites. Why? He just wanted them back. He wanted them back, and he was calling them back. And in time, in the fullness of time, I believe it is the way the New Testament says it, Jesus was sent, and he became the evening sacrifice, the last lamb, and a way was opened up that man could come to God, and in that was this man was going to be gathered as a bride for the Son into this place. And so what's the reason that heaven is known to be a state of high spirits is because in that moment, the people will be home and God will have his people forever. And both are delighted with the arrangement. They're glad to be there, and he's so glad they came. And the spirits are high, and there's a lot of praising, and there's a lot of worshiping, and there's a lot of benevolence. We'll talk about some verses in Ephesians where divinity is going to show through the ages the things to come. And you just have this, almost this honeymoon excitement. They really don't want to do anything else. They just want to be together, and they want to do together and stay together. And it's a state of elation. Revelation 21:3, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with them, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. This is the connection. And it's this time it'll be permanent. There will be no more falls, and we'll talk about that in a minute. The union of God with man forever. He's been looking for a little while. But heaven is the culmination of the plan of God. It's the nearest thing that I can compare it to is the honeymoon. I think it was Augustine that once said this quote. That's not the way he said it. He said, what if you can have the heaven of whatever design you wish, but in this you will never see his face? Is that a deal that would chill your soul? What if you could build whatever heaven you wanted to with the understanding that you wouldn't be joined with your Father who made you? I think the only people that would make that deal are the ones that are making it right now. The ones that are trying to build their heaven on earth, and it's the most heaven they'll ever get. Well, heaven is a state of elation. Number two, this is the easy one. It's the big one from the Civil War. It's a place of emancipation. Set free. How many no mores are there in these two chapters? Seven, if I do the math right. No, Revelation 21, verse 4. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death. Death is a cessation of life. Death is separation. Death is a cruel taskmaster. But death is native to all of us. All of us can think of someone that we know, that we are connected to, and they have died. And you know how that feels. And you know the emotions that go with that. The sorrow, the grief, the sadness. But death is native to all of us. Death is actually all around us. All of us are dying. Especially the ones with dandruff. That is dead cells laying on your shoulder. Where did they come from? They came from you, but they're dead. And we live in a world of death. According to the medical world, our cells are dying at such a rate that the entire body turns over every 7 years. You ain't what you were 7 years ago. None of us are. That's because we live in a dying world. We're born to die, and we are living in the land of the dying. I do believe that death is part of a mercy on God's part. He shushed the Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden so that they don't eat of the tree of life and live, because he did not want them to live in that state. There's a sense in which death is a mercy. It is our final separation from a fallen world. And it comes on us. We're familiar with death. Death claims some children before they are born. Death claims young children before we ever learn what they could have been. Death claims brides just before they could become a bride or just after they became a bride. Death takes young fathers when they appear to be sorely needed. Death takes middle-aged people while they are still being counted on for leadership. And then death is also sometimes the cruelest of taskmasters, where he tarries and we wonder why. My grandmother lived to be 96 years old. We do not know that she interacted with another human being for the last 5 years of her life. She just laid there. You put food on her lips, she'd open and she would eat. And then she would... I have an aunt that developed Alzheimer's. Same story. No connection. And the family begins to wonder, why, Lord? What's taking so long? What's the point? Well, in heaven, there's no more death. No more death. No weeping over caskets. No standing beside open graves. No more painful reminders as you drive by a spot and you think of what you did with that friend. It's over. And this is a state of emancipation, set free from the grip of death. Revelation 21:4 says, there is neither sorrow, no more sorrow. Even the most joyous death is sorrowful at best. But sorrow is much broader than death. Sorrow is mourning with the idea of pangs. Why do we mourn? Well, from what I can tell of life, mourning comes out of disappointments. Disappointments come when expectations are not fulfilled. We thought, we planned, we wished, we designed, and then it didn't happen, and we're sad. We sorrow. Disappointment comes from failure. I thought I could do better than that. I was trying not to be that way. And we are sad. We are sorrowful. Sorrow comes from failure to meet expectations. You get a new laundry set and the washer lasts 8 months and you have to claim the warranty. Dumb thing. Can't they make a better washer than that? Not in this world. Sometimes. You used to be able to get Maytags that would go 20 years, but they would break too. And I found that people with 20-year-old Maytags are sad about that. Dreams fail. Plans fail. People fail each other. People fail themselves. And all this failure leads to a multitude of sorrows. But in heaven, there is no more sorrows. Well, that must mean there's no more failure. Yeah, that's what it means. There is no more sorrow because failure is unknown. Coming up short is an unknown concept. There's nothing like fishing in your pocket for the money and coming up 2 pennies out. That doesn't happen in heaven because there's no more sorrow and there's no more failure and there's no coming up short. Revelation 21:4, there is no more crying. Why do people cry? There's about 4 reasons that I know of. They either cry out of frustration or disappointment. They cry out of fear or sometimes joy. That would be relief emotion. Or they cry out of sadness. Might be tears that come from anger. I don't know why people cry at ordinations. Which one of those is it? Is it the sorrow, the grief, or the joy? Or the anger? There must be another reason yet that I never came up with. Because we authorize ourselves to blow pretty hard. But that's only in America. I've noticed if I travel abroad, there's a lot more celebration when God calls people than there is here. I'm off the subject. There's no more crying in heaven. People cry out of frustration. Children cry out of hunger, but in heaven there's no hunger. There's plenty of food to go around. There's no frustration in heaven. They cry because of parting. There's no parting in heaven. They cry out of distress. There's no distress in heaven. They cry out of fear. There's no fear in heaven. We have security in the promised in this place. And so for all of the reasons that people cry on earth, we find that those reasons do not exist in heaven. Hence, there is no crying. It's pretty simple when you break it down like that. Well, Revelation 21:4 also says there's no more pain. The former things are passed away. Oh my. Pain. We get it 2 ways. We get it emotionally in our relationships, in our dreams, our desires, our wishes. And then we get it physically. Injury and disease. And we're all familiar with aches and pains. We have headaches and earaches and toothaches and neck aches and belly aches and back aches. And we crack our heads. We hammer our thumbs. We pinch our fingers. We bang our... And this all hurts. You get bursitis and arthritis and bronchitis and appendicitis and colitis and otitis and tendonitis, and it all hurts. But in heaven, there's no more. Do you see why people look at that and say, that's emancipation, that's a slave set free? It doesn't hurt anymore. That's heaven. There's a reason why we have no more pain in heaven. Read 1 Corinthians 15, 42 to 44, 53 to 54. We have a glorified body. In that resurrection, when the saints are moved from here to there, there is a transformation, a recreation. Read it in 1 Corinthians 15. So clear. I don't have to take this one. I'm not going to talk about all the scars that I have. Some are so small you couldn't see them unless you walk real close and looked. But they're there. And I don't think they'll be there up there. Number 5. I told you there were 7 no mores. There's no more temple in Revelation 21:22. Temples are the meeting places between deity and man. It's the way it's always been. You build a temple to meet your God. The Israelites did it. Tabernacle first, temple second. Religions of the world do it. There's some tiny little temples in Bangladesh. There's some pretty grand ones. And if you go to India, there's some incredibly grand ones. But it is a place for deity to meet man. But you don't need that kind of a structure when he is with them and they are with him. a temple would just get in the way. And so he says that there's no need of a temple. We don't have a meeting place. Y'all meet together on Sundays and some other times because you have a meeting place. It's where you come together. But what if y'all lived in this building? Okay, let's don't think about that too much. But the idea is there. What if y'all lived here? Then you wouldn't have meeting places. That's what heaven is. It says that there is no more night. That's over in 22, I believe. I didn't write the reference down here now. Verse 5, and there shall be no night there. Night, as far as I can tell, is given to us as a mercy from God to help us measure time. In the evening and the morning were the first day. That is how what night is for. It's also for rest. We should use it that way. And it's also a time for a part of God's creation to actually go forth. You can read that in Psalm 104. But in heaven, there is no need for night. We don't need to rest. We won't get tired. We'll be in a glorified state. And I'm going to stick my neck really far out with a speculation. I'm not sure that there's time in heaven. You can do with me what you want to, but I know that God runs in the present all the time because he calls himself I am that I am. And 1,000 years is like a day because they're all one thing. But be that where it may, there is no night there. That's emancipation. And then Revelation 22:4 says that there is no more curse. Please don't ask me to explain how much of the world I live in is actually subject to the curse. I'm pretty sure most of it is. I do not even know if the leaves fell off the tree before Adam and Eve sinned. I can't figure that out. Maybe they did, but that is death. When they turn yellow and brown. And the curse has wiggled its way into our existence very, very, very far. Vine's Concordance says that the curse is the action of God upon those who break his covenant. And we think of Adam and Eve, and we think of Cain, and we think of the children of Israel at Kadesh Barnea, and we think of Achan, and we think of Judah in the time of Jeremiah, and then Galatians 3, 9, and 10 just talk like, well, every man that sins is cursed under the law. And we live with that reality that the thorns and thistles that grew up in our pastures and in the corners of our yards and the middle of our flower beds, they weren't supposed to be there from the beginning, but they are. And how far it goes into our world, I don't know. Pretty far. I'm pretty sure that when I am privileged to be stepped away from this world to a place where there is no curse, it'll feel like the atmosphere just got about 1/10 of the density that it was before. It's just gone. The weights of the curse. You know, we'll have so much more time to think about profitable things instead of coping with all the things that the curse has broke. I mean, tomorrow, we'll go back to work, and I'm already thinking about a number of different steps of how we're going to go into this restaurant in a slot between 2 and 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, and we're going to turn the water off, and we're going to cut the pipes in half, and we're going to jerk that system out of there, and then we're going to put a temporary patch in there. And they said we can do it during the day if we keep it under 15 minutes, which will be a breeze. It's supposed to be. It might not work that way. I've had days that it didn't. And it just kind of bugs me. I'll think about it. It'll be one of the first things I think about tomorrow morning whenever I wake up. Do I have all the parts? Are all the tools in the truck? What are we going to do if that isn't enough? Because you feel like you have to prepare for that. There is a curse around here. But we will live free. Because the curse is gone. Life will be at least as good and possibly superior to the Garden of Eden. We don't know, how good the Garden of Eden was. We have some ways to speculate, but there is no more curse. Seven things that emancipate, set us free, because they're gone. They're not part of our existence. Number three, heaven will be a state of elevation. Just simply means to bring it up. But what this is really talking about is the way that the human mind will rise in its comprehension, in its understanding, in its awareness. The person, well, how do the scriptures talk about it? In 1 Corinthians 13, verses 9 to 12, in the love chapter, the scriptures talk about the child and how the child grows up. I'll just read the verses. For we know in part and we prophesy in part, but when that which is perfect is come, then that which is in part shall be done away. When I was a child, I spake as a child, I understood as a child, I thought as a child, but when I became a man, I put away childish things. For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know even as I am known. We don't actually know how well God knows us, but there are times in my experience that I draw comfort from the reality that I can get on my knees and talk to someone who knows me better than me. But heaven is a state of elevation. The awareness comes. Coming to Virginia has reminded me of my friend John Risser. And I just, when I got to this point, I had to think of all the questions and that John and I used to debate if we were passing the time driving down the road. And I thought to myself, it's not fair. John knows now. It's not fair. It's fair. God knows what he's doing. But that elevation comes in. 1 John 3, verse 2, Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it doth not appear what we shall be, but we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And it's the state of elevation. In Revelation chapter 2, this is the message to the church of Thyatira, verses 26 to 28. And he that overcometh and keepeth my works unto the end, to him I will give power over the nations, and he shall rule with a rod of iron, as the vessel of the potter shall they be broken to shivers, even as I received of my Father. And I will give him the morning star. And you just have this elevation. I'll make you a ruler. You'll be able to rule the nation. I can't rule the nations today. It looks like just about no one can. But we expect and we look forward to a state where we understand. And the questions that burn holes into our consciousness, and we fall asleep wondering, and we wake up in the middle of the night wondering, and we wake up the next morning still wondering, those days are over because heaven is a state of elevation. Number four, heaven will be heaven because of its continual revelation. I pulled this thought out of Ephesians 2, where the scriptures go down through this is the state of encounter, where you just encounter things. They're coming towards you, and you interact with them. But Ephesians 2 says it this way. It talks about how we used to be really, really bad. We were dead in trespasses and sin. And then in verse 4, God is rich in mercy, and he loves us. And then verse 5, we are quickened. And verse 6 says, he raises us up together and makes us to sit in heavenly places in Christ Jesus. And in the ages to come, he might show the riches of his grace and his kindness toward us through Christ. We do not have the human capacity to live by the age. When you start talking, okay, you can talk about decades, you can talk about centuries, you can talk about millenniums, but the days have passed that people move through that. Ages is somewhere beyond millenniums, at least from what I understand the description of the term. Maybe I'm misdefining the word. But it is this promise that we are sitting in a heavenly place, and then we are moved into a position where things are going to be coming toward us, that in the ages to come, he will show us the exceeding riches of his grace. I have no idea how it's going to happen, but I am looking forward to it. It sounds more entertaining than most of what we can do with our lives today. It's a state of encounter. We look forward to trips. We look forward to experiences. And we look forward to encountering things. We have bucket lists of places to go. And then we check them off. And the earth is bit by a something new bug. I've lost track of where we are on the iPhone count. But people, I guess, still stand in lines waiting to encounter the new iPhone. Poor people. Tell them to just get busy with their lives. And when God calls them, they can go into a place of encounter that's far better than waiting on an iPhone. Heaven will be heaven, number five, because it is a place of unending existence. And I just call it, for simplicity, I call it the state of eternity. Man has a beginning, but the soul has no ending as we know it. Just goes on. It just goes on. Revelation 22, 5 to 14. I didn't read all those verses, but basically what it's saying there is that we should pay attention to what was taught here because they're true, they're faithful. And verse 7 says that Jesus is going to come back, and if you're keeping the sayings of this book, then you will be safe. And John hears these things, and he's going to worship. And he said, no, don't worship the angel. You'll only worship God. And he says, don't seal up the prophecies of this book. The time is at hand. And then he moves into this language. He says, he that is unjust, let him be unjust still. And he that is filthy, let him be filthy still. And he that is righteous, let him be righteous still. And he that is holy, let him be holy still. Then behold, I come quickly, and my reward is with me, to give every man according to his work shall be. What are these verses saying? My attention is arrested when I keep hearing that word still, 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 still. And it's not the still that we started out with earlier in the week where we're talking about calm and collected and in control of our faculties. Be still and know that I'm God. It is yet still. One of the most fascinating things to observe about life is how what you can watch this happen in yourself and in people. But whatever you are today, you will be tomorrow, unless you change. That we'll just leave change out of this right now. Whatever you are right now, that is why it's no good to plan to go on a diet next week. Because if you don't curb right now, then you won't then either. Okay? And this is the way we humans are made. And there is a sense in which most souls go into eternity. Now, I told you the story of Marcellus being saved 30 hours before he died. And what a glory that was. But that's not normal. That is not normal. For every Marcellus, there's 250 people that are still the way they are now. And that's how they go into eternity. And basically what this is saying is that heaven is a state of what you are, you will be ever so more so. And he just simply says, if you're unjust, you will be unjust still. And if you are filthy, you will be filthy still. Because the normal pattern of life is that whatever we are today is what we will be then. Now, the grace of God does do work. And that's part of the work of our ongoing preaching and our counseling and our exhorting one another. That the people that ought to change will change. There's hope for that. Today is the day of salvation. But the norm, the standard operation, what's the Latin, operatus mundi or something like that, is that what I am now is what I will be then, and I will stay that way. This is the state of eternity, on and on, on and on. I lost track, let me back up. On and on, I still lost track. But it doesn't change. And there are false doctrines that have plagued the gospel of Jesus Christ on this very subject. Just a few weeks ago, I was riding with a man, and I knew him very briefly, and he told me that we were doing a work project together, and we had about an hour's drive, and we were visiting, and I said, let's see, are you a minister or a bishop in your church? He said, well, technically we're called overseers, but he said, well, after Saturday, I won't be anything. I said, what, are you quitting? Well, yeah. It's kind of like that. He said, the problem is that our congregation adopted a doctrine that I think is false, and I told them that they must either give it up or give me up, and they've chosen to give me up. I said, well, what's the doctrine? Well, he said, it's some weird doctrine. I don't understand it, but it's something about that only heaven is real and hell is just figurative and nobody actually goes to hell. I said, you have people at your church that believe this. He said, oh, yeah, they have Bible for it. I said, in other words, what they'd be saying with Revelation 22 is that only the positives are still, the other ones aren't. I guess it's something like that. So he said, as of Saturday, he said, I'm resigning from the church. He said, I'm not sure what I'm going to do. And this is not a new problem. People have tried to gainsay the doctrine of eternity for as long as there's been a gospel. And it's because they want to move the corners of the tent into such a place. I don't know all the reasons they do it because I've never had a real wholesome conversation with any of these people. I can only guess. But I just want to say tonight that the doctrine of eternity is real and true. And the scriptures, as I read them, are crystal clear that what you are today is what you will still be. And what you are when you get there is what you will still be. And as eternity rolls, as we say in songs, as eternity rolls, you are still. And that is horrific when you start thinking about habitations of torment and punishment. But that is glorious when you know your home. And the gulf between those two worlds is so great that a man can't go from one side to the other. And all of the people on this side don't want to go anyway. And so there's a tremendous amount of safety and security in knowing that when we get to the heavenly habitations, in the dwelling places that Jesus has prepared, in the company of our Jehovah God, we're locked. Still. The state of heaven is very appealing and attractive to me. As I was preparing these notes, I thought of an old gospel song that I used to hear at home. I don't know where I would go find it. It's one of them old recordings. But I don't even remember the whole song. I just remember the one line of the chorus. It was talking about heaven, and it said, no, I've never been there, but I sure do want to go. And that just, my young mind remembers that. The closing comments of Edward Bound's books was this: how the divine teacher emphasizes heaven. He wants our hearts to be there. If it will be there, I'm reading wrong. How the divine teacher emphasizes heaven. He wants our hearts to be there. If our heart must be there if we will ever get there. The heart is the soul, the being of man. Safety is in heaven. Put your values there only. Put your heart there. Never divide between heaven and earth. And all this man was saying is, if you sure do want to go, then your heart is there and has to be there if you'll ever get there. And there is safety in having your heart in heaven. Never divide between heaven and earth. I think I'm going to give an invitation this evening. If you don't know where you're headed after you die, we can help you figure that out. There is a path and a plan. Just would like to give everyone a chance to make their calling and election sure. What shall we sing?